Many in the church today ask, how did the Jews not recognize their own prophesied Messiah, their very own king? What if I told you that the answer to this question is really found in the rise and fall of countless false would-be messiahs who led political revolts just before Jesus was born, and possibly even during his toddler years? Today's guests are here to explain all of this right now. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Skywatch TV. I'm Joe Horn, and we begin week three of what has been an incredible series through the life of Jesus Christ from Genesis to Revelation in the brand new three-book anthology from Defender Publishing, The Mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation. And I'm once again going to try to grapple all three of these large volume books so that the people at home can get just a taste of what they look like when you hold them, when you wield them, when you read them. This is what many, and I said this in week one of this series, the people closest to the authors, Donna Howell, Allie Anderson, and my father, Dr. Thomas Horn, are describing as their magnum opus. My father feels like this series is the most important thing Defender Publishing has ever put out. And of course, we're attaching it to the largest giveaway of the year. But we need to dive right back into the content. If you missed last week's program, the week before, please go back.
Yeah.
This series has been explosive. I mean, we are just poking and pinpricking the edges of what's in this massive anthology. This week, we're going to switch gears. We've been covering the Old Testament. We're going to move into the New Testament now, and we're going to be talking with Allie Anderson about some of the research that she did for this series. And Allie, you know, according to you, it's very easy to kind of pivot from the Old Testament to the New Testament without even considering what events happened in history between the two. This is what scholars have termed the intertestamental period. And this area is actually crucial to understanding the gospel and Acts, is it not?
Yeah, the truth of the matter is that a lot of people don't realize there's actually a 400-year gap between the Old Testament and the New Testament. We'll talk a little bit about what was happening in the late part of the Old Testament, but when you understand historically the events that were aligning the way that they were around the time that Jesus was born and did his ministry and was crucified, when you kind of understand the cultural climate of that day, it puts an entirely different spin on why things played out the way they did. It's really easy to go from the last page of Malachi to the first page of Matthew and go, well, turn the page. So backing up into the Old Testament, one of the things that we have to understand is that Babylon overtook the southern kingdom. So they sacked the city of Jerusalem, they took the treasures, and they took the Jews in captivity back to Babylon, and they kept them there. And we kind of see that playing out during the Old Testament. Well, then Persia conquered Babylon and brought the Jews back home and let them return to their home. So we have this situation in the Old Testament where you have these Jews who have returned back to their home, and it's in ruins. And we see the final books of the Old Testament, you know, there's a lot of theme on rebuilding the wall and rebuilding different things that were torn down. This is because these people understood that they had brought judgment upon themselves by their actions. Every one of them made a personal mission never to see judgment fall on themselves like that again.
Okay.
So they became very devout and very legalistic. And then they went through this period of 400 years of silence. The prophets weren't speaking. God was silent. And so it's kind of this, well, we've returned home, we're trying to rebuild, but we don't have this intimate, super interactive relationship with God like we used to have. It's just complete silence. It's crickets. And it's like, did you forget about us, God? Where are we even at? What's the new normal with God, right? And they're trying to figure this out. And in the meantime, they keep leaning on these prophecies about a Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have these different factions kind of begin to emerge. First of all, you have the Pharisees. We kind of criminalize and villainize them in church now, you know, oh, the Pharisees. But the truth is the Pharisees were people who, after experiencing judgment from on high, they decided that they were going to follow the law to the letter of the law, the law, the law. And because it was the law, the law, the law, they became very close with the scribes. And so in their attempt over a period of 400 years to really nurture this whole holiness theme they had going on, They started adding new restrictions of holiness.
Right.
They separated themselves so much from the population that they lost their heart for people.
Right.
And they became all about this legalistic thing. So that's how the Pharisees actually came to be. It was actually an overcorrection of what was originally a really good intention. Then we had the Essenes, which, you know, Josh, you know all about the Essenes. And it's suspected that John the Baptist was an Essene, and they kind of just kept to themselves. Within the same political climate, we see the Zealots form. And they were political revolutionaries. They were waiting for the big Messiah to come along and overthrow Rome and any other earthly government and conquer the world and rule in a kingdom. And that's how it's going to be. It's going to be God kingdom on this earth. It's going to be political. It's going to be literal playing out in front of them through actual physical violent warfare. This is how the Messiah is going to come. And that's what they were watching for. And then we had the Sadducees, which were kind of an upper-class aristocratic group of Jews, which came out of the Maccabean Revolt. And they kind of developed a position of prestige, but they were kind of a liaison between the traditional Jewish religious institution and whatever current reigning power that was actually the governmental authority. Mm. They were kind of a liaison with that. And so with that came some corruption and some blurring of lines between what's really what God wants us to do versus what's convenient politically. And so you have this as kind of a lot of the elements of the religious institution at the time. So you have this population of people who has for 400 years waited for something from God. So hopefully for the Messiah,
sure.
They start placing their hope in everybody who might be some kind of a political activist.
I see.
And so then they start kind of honestly gaslighting themselves by all these, maybe this is the Messiah, and a guy will rise up and he'll start to look like maybe he's going to be the one. Mm-hmm. And I'm telling you, so now we're talking about a period of time where Rome is politically in charge, but the Jewish religious institution is still thriving. And so there's kind of a combat of powers there, but everybody knows that Rome's in charge. And as long as you don't rebel against Rome, Rome will let you practice your religious things. Just don't forget who's in charge, because if anybody tried to rebel against Rome, they would be immediately and violently responded to. A lot of people who only study the Bible are not familiar with the fact that there was an ancient city called Sepphoris. And Sepphoris was called the Ornament of Galilee, but that's not what it was called because it was pretty. It was called that because of its strategic location. Rome kept a really tight rein on Sepphoris because of its location. It was a great military location.
Okay.
Now, it's really important to understand that Sepphoris, up until about 60 or 70 AD, was a Jewish city. In fact, a lot of biblical scholars believe that Joshua fortified the city of Sepphoris. But a lot of people now say, well, that was a Hellenistic city. Well, that changeover didn't happen until 60 or 70 AD. So during the time around the birth of Jesus, Sepphoris was a place that was under the rule of Rome, but was a Jewish city with Jewish religious institution, you know, very prominent and operating in that setting. So there was a lot of political and religious friction in this setting. And then you have a population who keeps putting their hopes in this Messiah. And every time there's any kind of a rebellion or a revolt, it often centers around Sepphoris. So during this period of time, you have different people who were the would-be messiahs that people were placing their faith in. Judas of the Maccabean Circle, Rome's response was to raid the city, burn a large part of it, crucify 2,000 rebels, and sell more than 30,000 of these people into slavery. So the city of Sepphoris saw very serious violence if they did not really respond to the rule of Rome.
And you're moving past it very quickly, but I mean, that you just described a literal nightmare.
Yeah,
and if a person just imagines for just a half second that that's the city they live in and try to imagine what it must have been like, that is a nightmare.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So this is 4 BC when Herod the Great passed away. This is when all these people kind of started to, well, the Maccabean Revolt and a lot of different would-be messiahs around this time. In Acts chapter 5, Gamaliel, he mentions Thaddeus, Judas the Galilean. There are several. If you kind of Google around this time and just go would-be messiahs, you'll actually find a really long list. Well, you have this group of people that, like I mentioned, you know, this is one rebel that caused the city to be sacked, a lot of their buildings burned, more than 2,000 people crucified, and more than 30,000 people sold into slavery. That's just one instance.
Wow.
So now figure that these people are watching for a Messiah, but their attitude becomes, this Messiah has to overthrow Rome.
Oh, yeah.
There's no answer man that comes and saves us and doesn't deal with Rome.
Right.
There's no way this operates under the regime of this political and religious friction that's going on right now. So that's a large part of why they were watching for a political revolution. The other thing about Sepphoris that's really important to note, it was actually a metropolis. It was a really prominent marketplace. I'm going to tell you just a few things that the marketplace had to offer, because what I want to do is kind of draw the scope of how big this city was and how diverse not only the actual residential population was, but the traveling commerce was. So here, their marketplace had donkey caravans, extensive trade routes, which connected miles and miles of surrounding region from the Via Maris to the Mediterranean Sea. And these are just some of the things that were traded through this city. Grains, flax, breads, herbs, fish, all kinds of fresh produce, wine, ceramics, glassware. Here are some of the civic services that were available in the city of Sepphoris. Banks, treasuries, armories, court buildings, tax processing facilities, to name only a few. So this was a huge metropolis.
Yeah.
Okay, this is like modern day maybe LA or something.
Mm-hmm.
And what you have to understand is when people think of Jesus growing up, they think this rural setting.
That's right.
Where he's out in the middle of nowhere and there's like a mom's hanging clothes on the line. I don't know why they always depict that on movies, but they do. And but the truth of the matter is that Jesus grew up 4 miles away from this city.
Wow.
So Jesus was raised in this setting where there was not only a lot of different people coming and going, and a lot of commerce and a lot of business and things like that. But he also grew up in this setting where the political climate is, if you're going to claim to be a Messiah, you better do something about it.
Everything you're saying is so very interesting, because at the time that Christ came, the even many of the Jews, the religious leaders, like you're talking about, the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and oh, by the way, the reason they were called that is because the Sadducees did not believe in the resurrection, so they were sad, you see. But this was in the environment that Jesus came in, but that's also true of modern Israel today. That their idea of the coming Messiah, they're not looking for Jesus to descend from the heavens in the second coming. Mm-hmm. They are looking for a military leader.
Yeah.
And that's why we are being set up for arrival of Antichrist. The modern Jews, that is exactly what they're looking for, a totalitarian in the form of somebody that's going to dominate the political scene as well as the global scene. Uh-huh. So what was then is now again today.
Right. Yeah. And you can see that. I mean, you can absolutely see that hostile sides of two different teams warring. And we're going to take a quick break because we really want to make sure that you know how you can take advantage of the largest giveaway of the year with this beautiful three-book anthology from Defender Publishing that people are describing as Dr. Thomas Horn's magnum opus. And of course, we feel like this is probably the most important piece of legacy work that he's ever published. And so with its release, we want to make sure that you know how you can take advantage of some of the free gifts that we're offering with this special opportunity. We want to help with the holidays, so that you'll have some extra goodies, brand new gifts that you can hand out to your neighbors, your brothers or sisters.
It's over $2,000 in product, if you can imagine that. If you make your $35 donation, those three books alone would be $75 in any other market.
That's right, that's right.
And but everything else we're throwing in, I mean, the three-volume books, the new expanded ebook collection, that's up to 125 of our best-selling ebooks, the DVDs and the movies and everything that's in the commercial. So it's like a once-in-a-lifetime, and it is an inflation-busting opportunity for them to be able to get a lot of stuff that they then can repurpose as Christmas gifts.
So without further ado, take a look at this special opportunity, and we will be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen, Donna Howell, Dr. Thomas Horn, and Ali Anderson team up to bring you their magnum opus. Introducing the brand new three-volume anthology from Defender Publishing, The Mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation. This new collection is being described by those closest to Dr. Thomas Horn as the most important body of legacy work he's ever written. And it's being offered right now in Skywatch TV's largest giveaway of the year. Skywatch TV is proud to announce The Mystery of Jesus Grand Giveaway. Volume 1 of The Mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation begins in the Old Testament and reveals multiple ways that Jesus made personal appearances on earth called Christophanies prior to his birth through the Virgin Mary. The many links between Mount Sinai, the Day of Pentecost, and the Ascension from astounding but largely hidden revelations in the original Hebrew and Greek. How the words of the prophets regarding the someday Messiah preceded a 400-year season of silence and anticipation that led to disastrously incorrect interpretations of who he would be when he arrived, and so much more. Volume 2 begins in the New Testament and demonstrates what social and political events transpired during the intertestamental period that led to a movement of numerous false messiahs whose military pursuits splintered the Jews into various disjointed sects, each with their own misguided, documented messianic expectations. How extra-biblical and apocryphal books written around the time of Jesus give fresh insight on New Testament characters, their true identity and reputation, and how that affects proper biblical interpretation, the real and largely misunderstood purpose of Christ's ministry years on earth, and why there is an apparent deficit of miraculous manifestations in our day, and we're barely scratching the surface. Then Volume 3 moves directly to the Apocalypse, where you'll learn clear-cut, comprehensible explanations behind even the most enigmatic and hard-to-understand symbols in Revelation that anyone can read and understand. How Jesus, present and active in all 66 books of the Bible, makes his grand and final entrance in shining glory to welcome into the New Jerusalem all who receive the free gift of salvation. And we're just getting started. Presented in three brand new volumes, The Mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation is organized in a way that is guaranteed to fascinate and boggle the minds of everyone, from seasoned scholars to new believers. This is the life of Christ illuminated like you've never experienced before. When you order this incredible collection, you'll also receive the new Best of Defender Publishing ebook collection on data disc. Now, for the first time, this must-have assortment features 120 of the most information-packed best-selling books in Defender history, including the never-before digitally released version of the Defender Family Bible, featuring Old and New Testament with expanded Apocrypha. These full-length works are in popular ebook formats, so you can read them on Kindle, EPUB, PDF, and other handheld electronic devices. Give this collection as the ultimate gift to somebody you know this holiday season, or take them with you wherever you go. Valued at over $2,000 all by itself. But that's not all. With the holidays just around the corner, now's your chance to save big and receive bonus merchandise. As included in the Mystery of Jesus grand giveaway are any number of brand new super quality overstock gift books, DVDs, or audio sets to add to your library or give away as gifts this coming holiday season. Sold separately, these items hold a retail value of over $2,000. Yours now for your donation of only $35 plus shipping and handling. This is the largest giveaway of the year, just in time for the holiday gift-giving season, and is available only while supplies last. So don't delay. The Mystery of Jesus Grand Giveaway. Available now at SkyWatchTVStore.com. Order now or call 1-844-750-4985.
Welcome back to SkyWatch TV. I'm Joe Horn. We are in the middle of what has been a fascinating series on the new three-book anthology by Defender Publishing. Dr. Thomas Horn, Donna Howell, Ali Anderson, The Mystery of Jesus from Genesis to Revelation. We've pivoted from the Old Testament to the New Testament, and we're racing through this material as quickly as we can, and we're just pinpricking the edges of what is in this incredible series. But at one point, Pilate, so we're shifting gears now, he asks, "Is this Jesus King of the Jews?" What did he really mean by that question? Because on its face, I think people derive a lot of what they think is obvious, but they miss something.
Oh, they skim right over it. Okay, so I'm going to try to truncate a whole lot of things into one answer, but let me back up again to the Old Testament. When David was nearing the end of his reign, and his son Adonijah tried to steal the throne, and David had been told by God that Solomon would be the successor to the throne. I don't have time to get into it, but David finds out that Adonijah is trying to steal the throne, and he tells Solomon, "Take my mule and ride it to Gihon, where you will be anointed and appointed as king at Gihon. And then you ride that mule to Jerusalem with an entourage behind you celebrating, and they will proclaim, 'The king has arrived to claim the throne from the false king.'" That's, in a nutshell, I've got lots of notes, but in a nutshell, that's the Old Testament historical precedent for the triumphal entry. And then let's remember Zechariah 9:9 and a bunch of other Old Testament prophecies that talk about the Messiah coming in riding on a colt. So by this Old Testament precedent, this is how God basically straightens out when the throne is contested, who's the real king. But let me back up to the triumphal entry really quick here. You have Jesus riding in on a colt, and everybody in the crowd is responding, okay? Mm-hmm. The crowd is in it. They're waving leaves. They're singing, yep, Hosanna. The Sanhedrin would recognize this,
yeah,
as either a fulfillment of prophecy or an attempt to fulfill the prophecy. So they're looking at it going, is this guy a blasphemer? And he's trying to pull himself off as the Messiah? Mm-hmm. Or is this guy the Messiah? Nobody's overthrowing Rome. Can't be the Messiah.
Right.
You know, Rome's still here. No Messiah. Right. Like that's, they're just stuck
They've built
in their heads on that.
Expectation in their head, and now they're waiting for that Messiah to basically walk through the steps they've already predestined him to walk through.
Yes.
Right. And I would add really quickly, a lot of the prophecies were actually related to the millennial kingdom or the second coming were being interpreted as a now thing. So the prophecies that he has yet to fill in the future were being expected to be fulfilled in the first coming.
Yeah.
That
true.
Added a lot
true.
To the
and
issue.
I actually have a list of some of the things. In fact, I'll read a couple real quick. These are some of the things that the Psalms of Solomon said. This is what the Messiah is going to do.
Right.
He's going to prevent all sinners from inheriting any blessings of wisdom. I don't know where they got some of these things. Obliterate the support of the wicked with an iron rod. I mean, they're watching for warfare. But not only did the Sanhedrin recognize this as this guy is proclaiming himself to be the Messiah, he's doing this whole Solomon riding into Jerusalem thing, but Rome recognized this as a threat to the kingship. And you've got to understand too, and I wish I had time to get into this, Jesus kept talking about this ambiguous kingdom, my kingdom, and the kingdom of heaven. Well,
yeah,
that kingdom doesn't work for Rome. That kingdom magnifies the meek. It places the needs of the lowly above the wealth and the fancy powerfulness,
right,
of the rich people. So this strange, ambiguous kingdom's already a threat to Rome, but it can't be targeted. It doesn't have a location.
Right.
So they also can't target him. So when he rides in, Rome sees it as a threat. The Sanhedrin sees it as a threat. Mm-hmm. This Jesus guy is just becoming really inconvenient.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
right.
Pilate stands up. Shall I crucify your king? Is this the king of the Jews? Shall I crucify your king? We read that in our modern language, and we think that Pilate's saying, is this a good idea? Should I do it? But actually,
right,
that's not what he's saying.
Right.
He's basically calling to memory, remember what already happened.
Mm-hmm.
Remember your 30,000 friends that got sold into slavery,
yep,
just
right,
25 years ago or 30 years ago. Remember those 2,000 people we crucified. Remember all those neighbors that disappeared one day and you never saw them again. Remember these things. Is this your king?
Right.
Wow.
Identify yourself as a follower,
uh-huh,
and you'll be next.
Wow.
Who calls him king? Say it now. And then what's the crowd's response? We have no king but Caesar. Crucify him. They were petrified.
Oh,
and so there were three people besides Jesus' actual followers. There were,
wow,
three people in the crowd that day. Three kinds of people. One, the,
wow,
type that knew he was a religious problem.
Mm-hmm.
Two, the type that knew he was a political problem. And three, those who were just too scared.
Oh my goodness.
Just too scared.
Yeah.
Right. So the whole situation is they're daring somebody to step forward and acknowledge,
mm-hmm,
him as the Messiah.
Right.
Whether they may not be sure. And are they willing to gamble that they're right based on the consequences,
right,
that are being demonstrated in real time? Who will step forward? That kind of thing. It's horrifying.
Yeah.
And it didn't help that his forerunner had already been executed.
Right.
So how many would-be messiahs have they watched be crucified, and then,
right,
John the Baptist, and then he gets executed, and it's,
right,
it's just like...
And it's really easy to sit here in 2022 and say, well, you know what I would have done.
No.
Honestly.
Yeah.
Let's switch gears, Allie, with just a few minutes left on the clock. Sometimes, you know, Jesus' words about himself,
mm-hmm,
as we read through the Bible, are hard for us to understand today. And that's true for one important moment in the gospel narratives when he refers to himself as living water. Can you tell us why this statement of Christ made the Jews so angry?
Well, again, he was kind of proclaiming himself to be the fulfillment of prophecy. See, we skim over that, and we think Jesus is just walking around saying, I'm living water.
Yes.
I'm the light of the world. And
right,
you think, oh, that's really poetic and pretty. No, this was the feast where they would come together and they would read scriptures of prophecy about the Messiah coming, being the living water that would flow from Jerusalem into the surrounding areas of the world. They're praying over these scriptures. And right in the middle of this, Jesus stands up and says, I'm the light of the world. I am the living water. If you're thirsty, come to me. Well, that was a direct proclamation toward the religious leaders. I'm the guy you're looking for. Wow. And for them, that was, again, one of these moments where they say, this guy's got to go. Like, because what he's doing is he's changing the way we do things. He doesn't, he's healing on the Sabbath. He's putting the needs of a lowly person above our religious institutional rules.
Right.
And he's talking about the kingdom of God. By this point, he's overthrown the temple, you know, and chased out all the money changers. He's really an inconvenient guy for these religious guys who kind of had their whole little system figured out.
Right.
If you're going to overthrow Rome, then you have a lot of license to do nearly anything you want. To bring this into a modern context, do you remember when you were in school and one kid would act up and then the teacher would punish the whole class?
Mm-hmm.
You'd be like, dude, shut up. You're getting everybody in trouble. Stop. If the Messiah didn't stand up and fully overthrow Rome, all he was doing was making Rome mad.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and the religious institution, they were comfortable. They had a place where they were able to operate without too much friction with Rome, as long as nobody upset the apple cart. Well, when Jesus stood up and basically announced himself to be the Messiah, he was announcing to the religious institution that the Messiah was here. He was announcing to Rome that the gig was up. And so together, the religious and the governmental powers, that's when they both turned on Jesus. And it was kind of the final straw. They were kind of already turning on him at that point. They'd already tried to arrest him. They'd already interrogated him. They'd already kind of talked about crucifying him, you know, and that's kind of when it sealed the deal because he was just too much of a wild card.
That helps me to understand how the disciples were able to easily deny him. I've always wondered if you're loving that person and you know that person, how can you just in a moment, in a, just, I don't know this guy. I never knew him.
Right.
Makes me understand why he was so adamant about denial.
You can say, I will follow Jesus, I will do whatever, but if you've got kids, if you've got family, you know, I mean, you're thinking about who all am I willing to risk on this? Who in that moment, it's very likely that any of us would just get really scared.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
And here's the thing. The religious leaders in that day were absolutely determined to make sure that this Jesus was silenced. So determined, in fact, that a lot of the rules of the very Sanhedrin itself, as interpreted from the Mosaic Law, as that system, the legal system, had risen up from Babylon through Persia and forward in through the third century, these are just a few of the laws that were broke. First of all, there were no witnesses. Deuteronomy makes it clear there has to be at least two. Matthew 26, 59 through 60 and Mark 14 make it clear that they couldn't find any witnesses, so they brought in some false ones. There was a browbeating judge that not only tore his garment, which was in the court system at that time, verdict of blasphemy, but he made Jesus incriminate himself on his own evidence, which was forbidden in that law. It was not supposed to be that any court was allowed to happen at night, but it did with Jesus. There was a same day guilty verdict that was not allowed. That was an infraction. A closed court infraction also happened where they had two different hearings. And then the new council infraction. I don't have time to get into what of all of that means, but the point is they absolutely wanted this guy gone. What does that mean for our Christianity today? Jesus was not executed as a criminal. Jesus was murdered.
Oh.
Wow.
How many of you guys are hearing stuff from the Bible you've read a thousand times and missed bits and pieces of it? You're hearing it for the first time. Brand new in a way you've never heard before. When we continue this discussion, next week our panel returns to talk about why we might not be seeing miracles, sorcery, or magic in our modern time, and the answer is one I promise you will not see coming. Ladies and gentlemen, for everybody here in the studio, everybody on panel, I'm Joe Horn. Keep your eyes on the prize, which is Jesus Christ. We'll be back.